I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE, celebrating its Unity Day today on Flag Day. That's a UAE which has strongly condemned Israeli airstrikes on Gaza, Israel's illegal settlement expansion and military escalations in Gaza and the West Bank, and most recently statements from UK-US EU-armed Israel on displacing Palestinians from Gaza. This as the NATO nation-backed Israeli genocide in Gaza continues. But unlike under Genocide Joe, at least the latest chief facilitator of genocide, Donald Trump, revealed to the world who runs U.S. policy in the Middle East. Visiting the Knesset with his team, Trump pointed out Las Vegas casino oligarch widow Miriam Adelson as the force behind Washington support for the Holocaust. And so now we have Israel continuing to use its NATO-armed military, not just to threaten to exterminate Palestinians, but to persist in violating Lebanon, Syria, Iran, and other Arab nations after bombing Qatar. Just in the past few days, Israel's finance minister said, if Saudi Arabia tells us normalization in exchange for Palestinian state, friends, no thank you. Keep riding camels in the desert in Saudi Arabia. Trump, a friend of Saudi and the UAE, did, though, at least secure some kind of ceasefire in Palestine. But one of the hostages was not released. His name echoes through the occupied territories, just as once did the name Nelson Mandela in Soweto. Trump's Secretary of State Rubio, in between his plans for mass murder in Venezuela, managed to appear as if he had no idea who he was. Well, his name is Marwan Barghouti, and he's been tortured in Israel's dungeons for decades. Joining me now from Ramallah is Arab Barghouti, the son of Marwan Barghouti. Arab, thanks so much for coming back on Going Underground. Before we get to your father, since Trump's so-called ceasefire deal, Israel, of course, voted in the Knesset to take the entire West Bank. Where you are, anyone watching this program at home can just look on X and search for West Bank or Ramallah. Just now, at the time of this recording, it says occupation forces storming the village of Dur al-Qara in Ramallah district, heavy raids in Tamun, Kalkia, Kafr Saba, armed units southeast of Nablus. What's it like there in Ramallah?
I mean, you know, the West Bank is going through, as part of the collective punishment policy by the Israeli government that's been there since the creation of the State of Israel, but it got accelerated after October 7th. It's been a slow process of ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people that got accelerated after October 7th. Tens of thousands of Palestinians from the West Bank have been displaced from their homes. We have regular terrorist settlers attacks in the West Bank, and we try our best to exist on this land because our very existence apparently presents a problem to the current Israeli government. This is why we've been under an apartheid regime. It's very important for people to understand that the West Bank has been under occupation and an apartheid regime. And when we say apartheid, to give you an example, I was born in Jerusalem. I haven't been able to go to Jerusalem in 25 years. While, you know, any foreigner can apply and go to Jerusalem tomorrow, even if they don't have any ties to the city. It's 20 minutes from my house here. The other day I was sleeping, and at 3 a.m. I thought that I was dreaming when I heard Hebrew. But then I looked from the window and I saw tens of Israeli soldiers just down the street, stopping cars, terrorizing the people and so on. And this is so regular. And, you know, Ramallah is known to be quiet compared to Hebrew, Nablus, and many other Jenin, Tulkarem, and many other places who are going through way worse, and let alone the people of Gaza, the genocide of Gaza and so on.
And unlike in Gaza, there are international reporters there. And yet, even as they keep talking about the Mahmoud Abbas regime in Ramallah being legitimate, they don't seem to be reporting these daily occurrences. Is it daily, hourly, these war crimes?
So it depends where you are. In the south of the West Bank, in Hebron, for example, Masafer Yatta and those places, it's daily, 100%. The village that both my parents are from, which is 20 minutes from here, from Ramallah, called Kobar, is also under attacks in the last few weeks, especially at the season of harvesting the olive. And that's where they become way more motivated than I'm talking about the illegal settlers. To attack the population. And of course, let alone Jenin, the refugee camp of Jenin has been destroyed. Ain Shams refugee camp in Tulkarem, Balata refugee camp in Nablus. They have all been destroyed. And you know, it's the most that bothers me when I talk to Western journalists in general. They say, yeah, but they're attacking terrorists. No, I don't think they are. That's first. They're displacing civilians. And the other thing, why are we calling the IDF an army and the people that are defending under international law, defending themselves, the terrorists? So that gives you an idea of the double standards that finally is getting exposed. And it took 20,000 children, Palestinian children, to be slaughtered in front of the whole world for them to start changing their tone about talking about Palestine.
I mean, in fairness to the Trump administration, I don't think I can remember in my lifetime a senior U.S. official, in this case, J.D. Vance, immediately after that Knesset vote to annex the whole of the West Bank, showing anger at Israel. I've never seen anything like it before. I presume you were heartened by that. But that was just after Rubio, the Secretary of State, known Zionist, who Trump had previously called a puppet of Miriam Adelson, reiterated support for Israel. And he appeared to say he didn't know who your father was, or at least he said there's no update on that, in a sort of dismissive way after pretending. I don't know whether he could even hear the name of your father. Do you think Rubio was lying or ignorant about your father, or what do you think was going on that in that scene? On video, it was on camera.
Sure. Yeah, of course. I'm not sure, honestly, but what I know is that any Western leader that wants to bring peace and stability in the region, they must support the release of my father. My father represents a positive force for unifying the Palestinian people into a vision, a political vision that is accepted by the international community. The international community keeps claiming that they support a political settlement, they support coexistence, they support peace, they support two-state solution, and so on. Okay, here you have the most popular Palestinian leader, who is trusted by the Palestinian people, who has a political vision. And to prove that, if you go back to 2006, he's the one who initiated the prisoner's document, which is the most important document, one of the most important documents in Palestinian political history, because it was the only, until today, document signed by all Palestinian factions, including Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and so on, that stated on three main points. The first one is the creation and the establishment of the Palestinian state on the 67 borders. The second point is limiting resistance to within the 67 borders. And the third one is for the targeting of civilians is forbidden regardless of where they are. And I think that a Palestinian leader who has all that credibility and legitimacy by the Palestinian people to come and say that is a great opportunity for the international community to seize it and to prove that the recognition of Palestine is not only symbolic, but they are willing to take steps on the ground. Mm-hmm. And I can argue that releasing my father, you know, can advance that. And I'm really encouraged by the statement by President Trump that he's thinking about it and that he knows who he is.
Yeah. I mean, why do you think the UN, why do you think negotiators, let alone why do you think the media, ignore that prisoner's document, let alone the Arab peace plan, which echoes elements of that?
I think because there has been an unfortunate division within the Palestinian politics since 2007. And we need to take responsibility for that as Palestinians. And we need to unify. I don't think that, you know, putting the blame always on others. Of course, in order to solve the root cause of the problem, you have to end the occupation. The occupation is the root cause of the problem that we're in. And the occupation is illegal by international law, by Western governments, by law, by everything, by the UN, and so on. So unless we end that occupation, the cycle of violence won't end. But that doesn't mean that we don't have a responsibility as Palestinians to unify under a political program that is accepted by all of the Palestinian people. And that can only happen by having general transparent elections as soon as possible, because that will bring more youth to power. It will bring more participation of women in power. It will bring democracy. It will bring more plans into becoming an independent economy, prosperous economy, and so on. And that's what we call for.
And so remind us now about your father's transition and why he is called this Palestine's Nelson Mandela. I should say I interviewed Nelson Mandela here, the post-apartheid Nelson Mandela, as it were. Is it that transition that your father made from, Mandela made the transition, obviously, from extreme violence to unifying different anti-apartheid groups? But just remind us about your father's experiences of being in and out of prison all his life, before the latest sentence. He's now been in for, 20 years?
Yeah, he's been in prison now for 23 years this time. He spent 7 years before that in and out of prison. He if you go back to his track record, he's held many leadership positions since he was young. He was the head of the student council of Birzeit University, which was known to be, one of the most important places to understand the Palestinian politics back then, and where young leaders came out from in the 80s for 3 times in a row. And then he got exiled by the Israeli government in the 87 at the start of the First Intifada. He got voted as the youngest member of the Revolutionary Council of Fatah at the age of 29. He became the youngest parliament member at the age of 35. And he was always, he takes pride in the fact that he's always held positions only by elections and only by democracy. And that's been his vision. Now, to look at the transition and so on, like any oppressed people, we have the right to defend ourselves. We always hear in the media, Israel has the right to defend itself. What about Palestinians' rights of defending ourselves? And that's the case that my father has been making. But my father also is brave with self-defense, and also brave in political solutions and supporting political solutions. And that's why he was in the 90s supporting the peace process. And he did meet with Israelis. He wanted to build those bridges for the continuation of that process, but it was sabotaged by the far-right Israeli government that started after Ishaq Rabin assassination and Netanyahu came to power. And that's where the Palestinian uprising started. And he played the role of becoming the face of that uprising, and he didn't shy away from that. But he's not a military guy. He's a politician and has been always a politician. He called for the Palestinian rights, and he never shied away from the objective. And until now, if you ask him, he will tell you, my main objective is very clear: a future where Palestinian children are living in peace, a future where Palestinian people are free, living with dignity. But he's also flexible for solutions, and he holds PhD in political science. So, of course, he's going to support political solutions.
Arab Barghouti, I'll stop you there. More from the son of incarcerated Palestinian leader Marwan Barghouti after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Arab Barghouti, the son of Palestinian leader Marwan Barghouti. Arab, in the end of part one, you were talking about the pragmatism of your father. I don't know when the last time you've seen your father. There are reports, the diplomat Alistair Crook, the British former senior diplomat, friend of this show, said he was worried whether your father was even mentally okay after the torture by UK, US, EU armed Israeli authorities. You haven't even hugged your father since his kidnapping by Israel in 2002.
Yes, I haven't hugged him in more than 23 years, almost 24 years now, because it was a few months before his imprisonment. But on another note, I haven't seen him in 3 years. So I used to see him twice a month only until I turned 16. So it was only for the first 3 years. And then since 2006, I would see him once every 2 years, every 3 years. I haven't seen him in 3 years, and none of the family members have seen him in 3 years. After October 7th, it's very important for people to understand what's been happening inside Palestinian prisons. It's the other side or the backyard of the genocide that is happening inside the prisons. 79 Palestinian detainees have been killed inside prison, either by beatings, starvation, neglect, medical neglection, and so on. And I think that, you know, my father is part of that. And they what happened to him is that they sent him to solitary confinement to punish him for, you know, even though he had nothing to do with October 7th, but as part of the collective punishment and as part of targeting him as a leader, a representative of the Palestinian people, they sent him to solitary confinement. He was assaulted at the end of 2023, March of 24, September of 24. And then we just heard 2 weeks ago the scary and very disturbing stories from the released detainees who got exiled to Egypt. They gave testimonies, five of them gave testimonies that they saw him when he came to the solitary confinement section in Megiddo prison. So what happened on September 14th, the Nahshon unit, which is responsible for transferring the detainees, and they're known for being the most vicious and brutal against the prisoners, they moved him from Rimon prison, and they wanted to transfer him into Megiddo. So they stopped him at Al Jalama prison, and in there, eight prison guards, he was shackled in his hands and legs. They put him on the ground. They started kicking him and beating him up until he lost his conscious. And, you know, he stayed, he passed out for a few hours. He regained it back after hours. When he got to Megiddo prison, they sent him to the clinic. He had four ribs broken and got severe injuries in his head, and got back without any medical treatment to his cell. And we learned all of that when he from the released detainees, that when he woke up, he told them about all the stories, including the appalling video of Ben-Gvir when he went to him a couple of months ago and he taunted him and threatened him in front of the whole world.
So that latest torture was after the Israeli security minister Ben-Gvir tried to psychologically torture him on camera before the world. Was that before or after that?
That was after 1 month after, like a few weeks after that video. Ben-Gvir posted the video in mid-August, and that attack and assault happened in mid-September, but we only learned about it a couple of weeks ago because we don't have any access to him. The lawyer has been able to see him only for five or six times in the whole 2 years, in the last 2 years.
So that was in Ganot prison. And you're saying that he was transferred to two others based on the Egyptian detainees, surviving Egyptian detainees that were released. So why is he always being constantly moved from prison to prison?
So under the Israeli law, if you're in solitary confinement, and this is something, you know, part of the torture laws that Ben-Gvir is bringing to the table, detainee who's in solitary confinement, they have to be moved every 8 months. And you need to understand that the transfer process is one of the most vicious processes that you can go through because there are no cameras or surveillance, and the Nahshon unit is known for their hostility against the Palestinian detainees. So it's part of the torture. You know, my father, after October 7th, when he was moved at Ar-Ramla prison at first to the solitary confinement, he was put in a cell that could barely fit his body, no windows. He was not allowed to go to breaks according to the law. Of course, there is no law in there. And they would put a spotlight in his face to prevent him from sleeping. They would put speakers at the door of his cell, running the Israeli national anthem at the highest volume for days to prevent him from sleeping. So you're talking about the ugliest tactics, because these are the instructions of no other than Ben-Gvir. And people need to understand that Ben-Gvir is a security minister. He's not a random guy in Israel. And everyone knows what his motives are, what his intentions are, because he says that these are not secrets.
Yeah, I mean, I said Egyptians. They weren't Egyptian prisoners, of course. Any any information about how Western European powers and the United States are supplying these prisons for this torture? Do they know that this torture is going on as they continue to support Israel with the weapons? And it clearly, all of this gives the lie to anyone who says this is all about Hamas and this has anything to do with Hamas.
No, this is a clear a crime against humanity, which is collective punishment, because most of the detainees that were in prison, all of them got tortured, all of them got attacked. I have many cousins who went to prison, of course, under the administrative detention, which is illegal by international law in the first place, which is putting someone in prison without telling them why they're there, without going to the court, and so on. And they all got back, a different person, psychologically tortured, losing weight. They all lost weight. They all got tortured and so on. And I wanted to make sure that I clarify something. You said that people are concerned about my father's, a mental state. And I can tell you that with all of the what you've heard in terms of torture for my father, they heard from him last. So when I'm talking about the Palestinian detainees who got exiled to Egypt, these are the ones who heard from him last, because they were cells next to each other and they can speak to each other, but it's solitary, so he can't meet in person. But they would talk all the time. And they said that while he was recovering, barely recovered, what he did is that he started to teach those prisoners through the window, talking to them, giving them classes from 6 to 8 hours in political science, in history, in Israeli studies, and so on. Because you need to know something about my father. In Hadarim prison, where he stayed for 18 years out of the 23 years, he started what we call the Light Academy. And what we mean by the Light Academy, he sent his lawyer to the head of Jerusalem University and convinced him to give him the ability to give official degrees through sneaking the grades of the detainees while he is teaching them. And he was a very hard teacher, 7 days a week. He doesn't take breaks, 8 hours a day. And as I mentioned, he has a PhD in political science, so he's eligible to teach, and he used to teach in Jerusalem University. He's graduated more than 450 Palestinian detainees with bachelor's degrees, more than 200 with master's degrees in Israeli studies. He is, of course, fluent in Hebrew, Arabic, and English. And that's what he continued, despite all that torture, to try and teach them as good as he can. And they said that he was the one who is encouraging them, who's lifting their spirit, and so on. And I want to recall my father's one of my father's favorite quotes, when I say, "Our chains will be broken before we are." So I have no doubt that mentally he's the strongest person I've ever known in my life. But at the same time, I'm his son, and I am concerned for his life, because, you know, it's not crazy to think that the Israeli government would harm him.
At last, recognition of your father, as I said, questions of Marco Rubio, Trump's Secretary of State, so-called mainstream media of NATO nations arming the genocide, or calling him the Nelson Mandela of Palestine. Has your family met with Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority top officials regarding his case?
You know, I want to clarify something, which is the fact that my father used to always say that unity is the most important thing. And if we have differences with the PA, with others, it's because we love Palestine and we want the best for Palestine. And I know that there is this narrative that Fatah, for example, doesn't want my father to be released. And this is absurd. My father is a proud Fatah member for more than 50 years. He's a central committee member of Fatah. He was voted the highest votes twice of all of Fatah leaders by Fatah members. So he is loved by Fatah, and
Sorry to interrupt. We had Omar Awadl, a deputy foreign minister, on who corroborates what you just said there. But we're running out of time. So just very briefly, do you believe China and Russia I would love to talk to you more about the artistic ways in which the resistance has succeeded in educating the world as well about your father and the Palestinian struggle. But do you believe China and Russia should have done more to stop the genocide, perhaps militarily, rather than just their votes at the UN Security Council?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, everyone should have done better. The whole world watched a genocide unfolding in front of our eyes for more than 2 years, and still going. We saw the attacks and the bombardment. And, you know, as a Palestinian, I can't even express the disappointment that I have in humanity overall, in the double standards. The fact that everyone lost their minds on October 7th, and then when Palestinians started dying, it took them months and years to speak up. And I think that the only hope that I have, to be honest with you, is with the young generation, and that generation is getting self-taught and not by the mainstream media through TikTok and social media and so on. And I want to send my message to those generations that you are the hope for us as Palestinians and for all the people that are oppressed. And my message to them is that if you're pro-Palestinian, you're not only pro-Palestinian. And don't be pro-Palestinian, be pro-justice. And our struggle is the same struggle as the Sudanese people and the people that are oppressed all over the world. And we really hope that we can all unite against oppression and for justice, for a better future and a better, you know, life for future generations as well.
Arab Barghouti, thank you. That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US EU armed genocide across Palestine. We'll be back on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. It's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.